Chapter 3, Cultivating Metta. May all beings be happy and secure. May their hearts be wholesome. We have now come to a natural break in the sutta. Up to this point, the teaching has been about setting up preparatory conditions for the effective cultivation of metta. One might even say that if you fulfill these conditions, if you're capable, straight, upright, and so on, you will be in such a skillful, healthy frame of mind that you can't help wishing others well. It will be the natural thing for you to do, not only when you sit down to meditate, but all the time. Your mental and emotional state will be so positive that, quite spontaneously, you will wish for others to enjoy health, happiness, security, and peace of mind. The next section of the sutta begins with a phrase that sums up the generosity, the sincere and heartfelt regard for others, in which the cultivation of metta consists. We wish simply that beings may be happy and secure, and that their hearts may be wholesome. Kemino means secure, that is, free from danger, free from disturbance, free from fear. Sukhi simply means happy. Sukhitata is translated here as their hearts be wholesome. But the suffix atta means self or being, so the Pali term literally means of happy self or happy-hearted. To be precise, the whole phrase could be translated as may they be those whose self is happiness. This makes it clear that you want their happiness, their bliss, to be entirely within themselves, not dependent on external circumstances. In their essence, they should be happy. Happiness is not something they should have, but something they should be. It is happiness in this sense, together with the metta that produces such happiness for oneself and wants it for others, that characterizes the spiritual community. If you don't find a greater degree of metta and happiness in the spiritual community than you find in the world generally, it isn't really a spiritual community. The broad message of the first section of the sutta is that if we want to enjoy positive mental states, we must pay attention to our everyday activities, our thoughts and volitions, our speech and actions throughout the day. We should raise our consciousness in the only way that can generate a genuine transformation of being, by living out our ideals, by turning skillful actions into skillful habits, to the point where our mind naturally tends towards states of clarity, concentration, and happiness. This opening section of the sutta has essentially been a preparation for what is to come. The wish expressed in this verse, that all beings may be happy and secure, is more than a vague hope. It introduces the section of the sutta that is concerned with the technique of meditating on loving-kindness, and thus designed to help us to develop that aspiration for the well-being of others in a very real way. It is in the practice of formal meditation, when the mind is brought to bear directly on the mind, that metta is cultivated most intensely. The next section, again of 2.5 verses, sets forth the means by which we can develop that metta. It does so through what is effectively a description of the metta bhavana practice, the meditation on loving kindness taught by the Buddha himself, which is, as we have seen, an indispensable aspect of the path to the attainment of the state of calm or nirvana. Whatever living beings there be, feeble or strong, tall, stout or medium, short, small or large, without exception, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those who are born or those who are to be born. May all beings be happy. The whole world of beings. The aim of any meditation practice is to train the mind and thereby to heighten and transform consciousness. In the Metta-Bhavana meditation, this training takes the form of various explicitly formulated aspirations and wishes for the welfare of different classes of beings and for their abstaining from various forms of unskillful behaviour. Calling to mind those categories of beings and directing thoughts of loving-kindness towards them, you engender loving-kindness towards real people, as many of them as possible. In the course of your meditation, you bring to mind all the weak, helpless beings, all the strong and healthy ones, and then beings of various shapes and sizes, right down to those beings who are too small to be seen at all, which presumably refers to microbes and single-celled organisms, as well as to those beyond human perception in other ways. You call to mind those who are as far away as you can possibly imagine, and those nearby. This is one systematic way of developing metta. In other forms of the practice, you concentrate on the geographical differentiation of beings by directing your metta towards all beings in the eastern quarter, all those in the south, the west, and the north, and finally, all those above and below you. You then call to mind those born and those unborn, thus reminding yourself that your metta is not limited by time or space. In this way, the sutta addresses the central problems of cultivating metta. Firstly, there is the sheer scale of its reference. If you sat down to meditate and found yourself immediately full of metta, you could no doubt direct that metta towards any class of beings that you wished. But probably very few people would find themselves in that position. A methodical approach is therefore necessary if you are going to get anywhere with the practice. Otherwise, you would wish for all beings without number to be well and, after a brief but mind-boggling attempt to visualize them all, you would pass on to the next meditation. The second problem is that metta is impersonal in the sense that it has no specific object, while at the same time it is not at all woolly. A vague sense that you wish everyone well, together with a generalized impression of everyone, won't do. Ultimately, metta may be without any object, but to begin with, you have to develop it in relation to actual specific persons, otherwise your emotions will not get involved. You have to begin closer to home. And the same goes for other reflective practices, the contemplation of impermanence, for example. Another practical reason for the sutta's detailed roster of the recipients of metta is to counteract any irrational dislike you may have for certain categories of people. One would do well to draw up a list of one's own prejudices to make the list as inclusive as possible. You might have a prejudice against tall people, or fat people, or men with beards, or blonde women. Since there is no accounting for taste, or indeed distaste, it is as well to include those formerly in the practice, as well as trying to become aware of those categories of beings you have overlooked altogether. The Metta-Bhavana practice. The technique of the Metta-Bhavana is based on the principle that the more strongly you feel metta towards one person, the easier it will be to experience the same emotion towards someone else. There are many variations of the Metta-Bhavana practice, including the one outlined by the Buddha here, and a version contained in the Visuddhimagga, Buddhaghosa's 5th century exposition of the Buddha's teaching as found in the Pali Canon. But all the variations share their working method with other Buddhist contemplations and meditations for the cultivation of particular kinds of awareness or understanding. In the contemplation of impermanence, for example, you call to mind a number of things that can be identified as impermanent, some quite easily, others with a little more difficulty. This helps you to deepen a fundamental awareness of impermanence as being in the nature of all conditioned existence. The general methodology is the same in the case of the cultivation of metta. Universal loving-kindness is not the easiest of emotions to cultivate, but there do exist various effective stage-by-stage ways of doing it. The more or less standard way of practicing the metta bhavana is in 5 stages, each of which takes your metta deeper. First, you generate metta towards yourself, then towards a good friend, thirdly, towards a neutral person, someone whom you know but for whom you have no particularly strong feelings, and fourthly, towards an enemy, someone you find difficult for some reason. In the 5th stage, you try to feel metta for all 4 persons equally, then conclude the practice by radiating your metta outward in wider and wider circles. The main thing is to get your metta flowing and bring to mind the 4 different persons, and then equalizing the metta seems to do that most effectively. Thereafter, you can either go all round the world in your imagination, country by country, continent by continent, or you can take up the traditional method of dividing the globe into 4 directions or quarters, north, south, east and west, and radiating your metta in each direction in turn. Another method is to consider variations on the sutta's different categories of beings, say, the rich, the poor, the well, the sick, the young, the old, animals, birds, fish, and so on. You can try any combination of these approaches to the 5th and last stage. Once you've got the metta flowing, it doesn't really matter which method you follow, as long as you include everyone, indeed all beings, everywhere. The technique of the metta bhavana is based on the principle that the more strongly you feel metta towards one person, the easier it will be to experience the same emotion towards someone else who is less obviously a candidate for your affection. By bringing all those categories of being to mind, one after the other, you give yourself the best possible opportunity to amplify and deepen your experience of metta. Let none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. Let him not wish any harm to another in anger or ill will. Responding with metta. Having established the scope of the practice, the sutta moves on to explore further the quality of metta we are aiming to develop. Although the form of the practice in 5 stages is not explicitly mentioned here, each stage presents its own challenges when it comes to keeping the flow of metta going. But before we look at these in turn, we can get from the text a general sense of what we are aiming to do. This verse shows us the response of metta to the betrayals and slights, the abuse and malice that comes to us from other people, and also, by implication, the positive spirit in which we should acknowledge our own unskillful actions. To begin with, if you truly desire the happiness of others as much as you desire your own, there will be no question of misleading them or lying to them. Any attempt at deception is almost always motivated by calculated self-interest, which is the very antithesis of metta. Even when no calculation is involved, It is dreadfully easy to belittle or humiliate someone with a few casual words. But although it is so easily done, it is no small matter. It betrays a terrible failure of meta, a thoughtless discounting of another person. This translation usually renders dukkha as harm. The term generally refers to misery, unhappiness, or even simple disappointment. None of which unpleasant or painful states of mind is necessarily connected to physical harm. Dukkha can also be understood to mean the opposite of peace or santa, the ultimate goal or good which is our real aim in life and towards which the Buddha, the Santikaya, directs us through his teaching. Dukkha is the fundamental experience of unease inherent in conditioned existence. In this context, however, dukkha refers specifically to suffering wished upon us by someone else, out of anger or ill will. As such, it can indeed be translated as harm. To be angry is not necessarily to wish harm upon someone. The Pali term, translated here as anger, osana, is the momentary flash of rage that might cause you to lose your temper. It is the result of frustrated energy. You want to do something, have something, or see something happen. And when your wish is blocked in some way, the energy that has been restricted or frustrated bursts through in an explosion of bad temper. Anger is an emotion of the moment. If there is a desire to cause harm, it is momentary and instinctive. Patika, on the other hand, translated here as ill will, is more sinister, involving a conscious, even calculated desire to do harm. Pratika is thus a much stronger term than simple ill will. At the very least, it means violent malice, and it usually refers to a state of rage, an uncontrolled, unreasoned, almost mindless determination to wreak harm and suffering on another person. Pratika can be taken to stand for all those deeply unskillful states which are antithetical to metta. As well as malice, there is cruelty, a gratuitous pleasure in inflicting harm, which in its extreme form involves sadism. The key difference between these deeply unpleasant mental states and anger is that whereas malice, cruelty and sadism continue over time, indeed are sometimes nursed for years, anger is an emotion of the moment. But if anger remains unexpressed, it will turn into something that settles down and anchors itself to become a resentment or even hatred. It is hatred, not anger, that is the real enemy of metta. It is the conscious, fixed and settled desire to do harm which we have to guard against and which is hatred's defining quality. Negative emotions are more closely connected than we might think. They are all expressions of the fundamental wish to do harm to others. Hatred can arise in many forms, in many kinds of situations. It is when some everyday occurrence sparks off a momentary sense of ill will that the deeper, darker residue of hatred emerges. When we get angry, our sudden anger can toss a match into a kind of tinderbox of hatred, sparking off cruelty, rage or malice. If we are prone to anger in the sense of osana, it can be difficult to rein it in, because once we have lost our temper, we are no longer susceptible to reason. We need to be especially on our guard when we feel our anger is justified, as a sense of righteous indignation opens the gates for more destructive emotions. All the same, compared to pratika, anger is a relatively healthy reaction. Sometimes letting off a bit of steam in an innocuous context is better than bottling it up. Why do we hate? There is such a thing as hatred at first sight. Hatred is the antithesis of human growth and development. With craving and ignorance, it is one of the three unskillful roots, akusala mulas, that feed and sustain our lower nature. It is perhaps strange to reflect that hatred is a uniquely human quality. Animals may compete to the death for natural resources, fighting one another, feeding upon one another, even killing for amusement, and yet, as far as we know, they do not harbour any conscious intention to do harm. So why do humans have this particular capacity for evil? Although we share a common ancestry, human beings have a quality that animals do not: the capacity for reason. It can lead to great good, of course, but unfortunately, it can also lead to hatred. We experience suffering as animals do, but we also have an ability to seek and find causes for our unhappiness and to extrapolate from knowledge of our own motives in such a way as to attribute motives to other beings. According to the 17th century Dutch philosopher Spinoza, if you have a feeling of pain accompanied by the idea of the pain's external cause, your response will be hatred towards that external cause. Hatred, in other words, is as much an idea as a feeling. We hate whatever or whoever we may see responsible for the unhappiness we feel. But this still does not really explain what happens. Indeed, there seems to be no rational explanation. After all, if you were suffering and realized that another person was the cause, and if you were able to keep out of their way or to stop them from hurting you, there would be no reason for your wanting to inflict harm upon them. Unfortunately, however, when you are suffering, you don't just want to remove the instrument of your unhappiness. You also have an urge to retaliate by inflicting a degree of suffering on them that will satisfy you emotionally, an urge that has no basis for reason. Another thing that marks us out from animals is our consciousness of the passing of time, and this also plays a part in the arising of hatred. Every time we allow the memory of a supposed wrong to run through our mind, hatred accumulates until a fixed attitude develops. From then on, whatever our enemy does, we interpret their actions according to that fixed view, and they simply cannot do anything to please us. While emotions are essentially active, we nonetheless create them from the raw material of feelings, and these come to us passively, to be taken up and given meaning and direction by the activity of the mind. Feelings in themselves, whether pleasant or unpleasant, are karmically neutral. They are the results of our previous actions. As such, it is how we deal with them, not the fact of our feeling them, that is of decisive importance. If you have a painful experience, you need not manufacture hatred out of it. If you do, you render yourself liable to further painful feelings in the future, because by reacting with anger, you have created fresh and unskillful karma. So hatred is not something that just happens to you. Like any other emotion, craving, say, or metta, it is something you do. Feelings are presented to you. You experience them. But whether you create harmful or unhelpful emotions out of them is up to you. The point is that our dislikes and resentments are often not based on anything people have actually done. They may come from our irrational expectations, or they may be a matter of interpersonal chemistry. There is such a thing as hatred at first sight. Someone may have an emotional quality that you pick up on and react against without your even knowing them. Or they may unconsciously remind you of someone else, perhaps a parent or a sibling, an ex-lover, or someone else from your past with whom you have had difficulties. This is what psychologists call projection. Likewise, a small incident can spark off an outburst of anger or irritability, awakening an emotion connected with some suppressed incident or series of incidents long ago and far away. A great deal of our latent tendency towards ill will is likely to stem from our early conditioning. It is easy to recognise people whose early life has been comparatively untroubled, as they are relatively straightforward, open and receptive. Others are much more suspicious, reserved and wary, and this may be a result of their early experience. It seems that many of us have a certain residual resentment, or even hatred, that lingers from our childhood and tends to attach itself to objects and people as we make our way through adult life. Sometimes these negative feelings are found to be attached to close relatives. If we are prepared to look for them there, although many people are shocked at the idea of feeling animosity towards their nearest and dearest. When such feelings do come out into the open, the resulting family disturbance can be particularly painful. If you think there is no one you dislike, it might be revealing to try putting one of your relatives in the fourth stage of the metta-bhavana, in which metta is directed towards an enemy, and see what happens. If we live with someone or work closely with them, or share a circle of friends with them, and have no particular reason to dislike them, we often fail to realise that, all the same, we do dislike them. It seems to be a sort of rule that there will always be someone we dislike among our acquaintances or colleagues. When that person leaves, another person with whom we have previously been on good terms may well take their place, to be the next object for the residue of hatred that is so difficult to shift from the human psyche. This is why removing someone from a situation of conflict rarely solves the problem in the long run. We should try not to feel discouraged by all of this. It is true that to wake up in the morning with an overwhelming wish for the happiness and bliss of absolutely everyone is highly unusual, even if one aspires to do so. Even after a great deal of intense effort in meditation, a tidal wave of universal love is unlikely to sweep us off our feet and carry us away. We shouldn't really be surprised. In trying to cultivate metta, we are swimming against the current of our human nature as it has evolved over millions of years from its animal origins. Sometimes we simply feel like a rest. As we struggle against the stream of our habitual negativity, metta seems just too much to ask of ourselves. The tendency to feel hatred for others, even for people who pose no threat, comes all too easily to us. It is a basic human trait. It should be no surprise that the world is so full of conflicts, wars and fatal misunderstandings. As beings with reflective consciousness, with a sense of ourselves as continuous identities moving through time, our defences are naturally directed against the threat of attack, not just upon our bodies, but also upon our fragile sense of who we think we are. This is why cultivating metta is such a challenge. It is an attempt to reverse our usual way of experiencing the world and ourselves. If hatred is specifically a human reaction to a threat, in its most primitive form, it originates from any threat to our specifically human sense of self, the most basic sense of who we are. Indeed, to identify with a self in that limited sense is to open ourselves up to that primal threat. Thus, to identify with a self is to be susceptible to the arising of hatred. If we think in terms of karma and rebirth, we have been prone to hatred for as long as we have been embodied human beings. It is as though hatred were woven into the very fabric of our being. Since our first human birth, we have reacted with hatred to all those situations that threatened the integrity of our continued existence. When a human being experiences this sense of being threatened, there is more at stake than territory or physical safety. We are afraid for our personal identity, our very sense of self, the sense of I that enables a human being to interact and form relationships in much more complex ways than animals can. A threat to the self is a threat not just to our physical well-being, but to our psychological security. If you succeeded in perfecting the practice of the Metta Bhavana, it would suggest that you no longer felt any threat from anybody, and therefore that you no longer identified your being with your contingent personality. But for as long as you are a worldly personality, the potential for hatred will always be there. You can detect it in yourself sometimes. A little flash of undiluted hatred, often when you least expect it. The enemy within. How strange it is that we do not wish quite naturally and wholeheartedly others the deepest happiness and bliss. It is painful to realize that a mind dogged by hatred or irritability continues to harbor a stock of resentment regardless of circumstances, a residue of ill will that will always seek out an object in order to express itself. But such apparently irrational reactions are not necessarily a bad thing. If we never catch sight of our projections, how will we learn to see through them? Psychological projection is unconscious, but our bringing our unconscious reactions into awareness, we begin to act more appropriately and put down the psychological burdens we have been carrying. To transform emotions, we need to feel them. But in doing so, we have to take into account an external reality with which our feelings and urges are not necessarily in touch. We should take care to do this, especially if, as is likely, that external reality involves other people. No one can dispute that we feel what we feel. But we need to ask ourselves whether our feelings correspond to reality, whether they are adequate to the situation. From the authoritative way in which many people speak about how they feel, it would seem that they believe that invoking their feelings excuses them from considering objective reality, and that their feelings about it constitute a fully adequate assessment of the situation. Of course, no one should be allowed to get away with this. By all means, have emotions. Be as emotional as you like. But let them be true to the situation. Don't dress up peevishness or fury as clear thinking and straight talking. If the intellect is to support the emotions have to return the favour and support the intellect. When we are indulging in a subjective and perhaps negative emotion, we very often know in our heart of hearts that our response is not really true to the way things are. When we get angry with someone for a trivial reason, we know, if we are even just a little aware, that the situation does not justify that emotional reaction. When this happens, instead of thinking, "Oh, I must get rid of my negative emotions," ask yourself, what is the objective situation? Are my emotions appropriate to what is really going on? The harmful states that are the enemies of metta can arise in many different forms, gross and subtle. If you are in a happy, upbeat mood, and you mix with people who are not, they may want to share your happiness. But it is also possible that they will prefer to see you as being no less unhappy than they are themselves. They may resent your happiness and feel they have to resist it or even destroy it, as if it were an affront or a challenge to them. Perhaps they want you to show their misery a little respect, or suspect that you are feeling superior and smug. Humans are contradictory beings. How strange it is that we do not quite naturally and wholeheartedly wish others the deepest happiness and bliss. It's as if we feel that there is only so much happiness to go round, and if the others are happy, then there is less happiness left over for us. Certainly, people often feel they have a limited quantity of love to be preserved for close friends and family. But of course, the happiness of others cannot do us or them anything but good. Our task in practicing the metta bhavana is to learn to extend our metta beyond this very small circle, bit by bit, until it encompasses all beings. In the five-stage version of the practice, we begin very close to home indeed, with ourselves. This makes perfect sense. If, as we have seen, the enemy is within, it is within that the enemy needs to be tackled, indeed, needs to be transformed from an enemy into a friend. Doing the metta bhavana. First stage, metta for oneself. There is a place for selflessness in Buddhism, but not for acquiescence in the face of ill treatment or a grey and unrewarding environment. Human beings need food, light, space, periods of peace and quiet, human companionship, friendship, and so on. We are naturally geared to look for delight in the world. You simply cannot develop much loving kindness towards anyone else if you are on bad terms with yourself, or if you are uncomfortable with what you find out about yourself when all your external supports and comforts are removed. This is why, in the first stage of the metta bhavana meditation, you begin by cultivating metta towards yourself. Most people find that this is not at all easy. Only too often, the residue of hatred within us is directed towards ourselves. The solution for many of us lies in our relationships with other people. One way to learn to feel metta towards yourself is through becoming aware that someone else feels goodwill towards you, and in this way coming to feel it for yourself. This is rather tricky. When you don't have metta for yourself, you experience an emptiness, a hunger, and you look for love from someone else to fill that void and make you feel better, at least for the time being. You clutch at love, demanding it as compensation for the unconditional acceptance that you are unable to give yourself. But this can only be a substitute for the real thing. You try to squeeze as much love as you can get out of others, even though that love is something only you can give yourself. It is as though you need them to do it for you. Being dependent on their love, you cannot care for their welfare except in relation to yourself. You cannot feel metta for them because of your own neediness. For many people, this is surely a depressingly familiar picture. But if you find yourself in this situation, all is not lost. By calmly reasoning with yourself, you can begin to turn that misapprehension around using the substitute love shown by others to help you to develop metta towards yourself. If they can feel good towards you, you can learn to feel the same positive emotion towards yourself, and thus gradually learn to stand on your own feet emotionally. Even though you may have begun with the assumption that you were not worth much, you learn from the other person that you were mistaken and thus begin to appreciate your own worth. You allow the knowledge that another person feels that you are generally worthwhile to percolate through your mind. You can learn to love yourself, in other words, by realizing that someone else really values you. Feeling meta for oneself is often simply a question of dropping the habit of self-criticism and allowing the objective reality of the situation to arise. Whatever you have done, however great your failings, the honest intention to develop metta towards yourself and all living beings can be a source of happiness in itself. Feeling metta for oneself is the keystone of contentment. And when you are contented, you can maintain your equanimity no matter in what circumstances you find yourself. It is a resilient, deeply rooted state of peace, a source of energy and confidence. Contentment is, moreover, an inherently active state, with nothing of the resignation or passivity that is sometimes associated with it. The contented person is both inspired and an inspiration to others. It isn't a question of just gritting your teeth and grinding your way through some awful situation. There is a place for selflessness in Buddhism, but not for acquiescence in the face of ill-treatment or a grey and unrewarding environment. Human beings need food, light, space, periods of peace and quiet, human companionship, friendship, and so on. We are naturally geared to look for delight in the world, but if you are contented, you can find delight in the world around you, even when you don't have everything you would like. The way to cultivate contentment is to bring a lighter touch to your experience. It is to enjoy what is enjoyable in it, but not to become attached to your pleasures, nor overwhelmed when things appear to be not going your way, in the knowledge that both the pleasures and the pains of life are impermanent. Contentment comes from being aware that as long as you depend on external objects for a sense of well-being, your happiness can never be guaranteed. Developing metta consists largely of finding contentment in oneself and living by that. Once it becomes a way of life, one stands a good chance of communicating that peace of mind to everyone with whom one comes into contact. Thus, the first stage of the metta bhavana practice flows naturally into the second. Doing the metta bhavana. Second stage, metta for a friend. A trusting and open friendship is an excellent context within which to bring your fears and antagonisms to the surface and begin to lay them aside. In the second stage of the practice, we call to mind a good friend and direct our metta towards them. But if our ultimate aim is to feel metta for everyone, doesn't this carry with it the danger that we will get this far and no further? Isn't it rather exclusive? Here, we need to take a pragmatic approach. Although we can do our best to respond positively to everyone, if we are going to explore friendship in any great depth, we can do this in practice with only a limited number of people. Friendship requires a level of trust and intimacy that can arise only through spending a lot of time with a person, becoming a significant part of their life, and allowing them to become a significant part of our own. We need not think of our circle of friends as being exclusive. It is simply a fact that we cannot develop depth and intensity in our relationships without making a firm decision to deepen our friendships with just a few people. This remains true even when one has a great deal of spiritual experience. Perhaps after years of practice, you will no longer experience partiality in your friendships, and will be able to be equally friendly towards anyone you happen to meet, taking life as it comes, and relating to everyone equally warmly, with an equally genuine sense of desire for their well-being. But with the best will in the world, your capacity for friendship will still be limited by the number of people with whom you are realistically able to come into contact. Thus, one can cultivate metta as a universal and ever-expanding care for all beings, whether near or far, while at the same time enjoying substantial relationships of trust and affection with those with whom one has chosen to enter into a closer relationship. Committed friendship demands personal contact, and that requires both time and opportunity. But a friendly disposition is another matter. There is no limit to the number of people towards whom we can feel genuinely friendly, and with whom we could potentially be friends. And that friendliness, however strongly felt, can only improve the depth of our existing friendships. Committed friendship obviously involves openness, and this calls for patience and empathy when what our friends reveal to us turns out to be difficult or even hurtful. A trusting and opening friendship is an excellent context within which to bring out fears and antagonisms to the surface and begin to lay them aside. But if this is to happen, the friendship must have a spiritual dimension, because hatred is far more than the psychological phenomenon that we have been examining so far. Just as metta is a spiritual rather than a psychological quality, so its antithesis, hatred, is not just a psychological state, but a spiritually destructive force operating within us. It is perhaps not surprising that when we start to practice the later stages of the metta bhavana, we can find the going difficult. We may even discover, if we are honest with ourselves, that despite our good intentions, we do not, as a rule, experience much desire for the happiness and well-being of even our closest friends. A famous moralist once observed that in the misfortune of our best friends, we always find something which is not displeasing to us. It would seem that even our friends represent some kind of threat. Perhaps this is why ex-lovers are able to do such harm to each other, and why the breakup of a marriage can be so acrimonious. Both partners know each other's weak spots only too well. It is the person with whom you have fully lowered your guard who can do you the most damage if the relationship changes. It's all about power. If some misfortune befalls our friends and they are brought down a peg or two, or suffer some disappointment, they are made, as it were, less powerful in relation to us, and the threat is to some extent removed. Sometimes we cannot help finding pleasure in that, however fond of them we might be. If you are very observant and honest with yourself, you will notice these little flashes of pleasure from time to time, at the adversity suffered by even your dearest friends. It is sad, but true. At the same time, and this is an encouraging thought, we don't have to act upon our feelings. Our task is to experience our negative emotions and then find a way to change them. If we never get to know these emotions, if we indulge them unthinkingly or try to deny them, no transformation will be possible. One of the skills you need to develop as a meditator is therefore to learn to broaden the scope of your emotional awareness, without allowing completely unmindful expression of what you start to feel. This is by no means easy. It requires experience, patience, the clarity and kindness of your friends, and gentle persistence in the metta bhavana practice. doing the metta bhavana. Third stage, feeling metta for a neutral person. Just as the sun is not selective in the giving of its light and warmth, when you feel metta, you don't choose its recipients or keep it for those you deem worthy of it. In the third stage of the metta bhavana, you direct metta towards someone you know hardly at all, someone who has only a very minor walk-on part in your life. Perhaps the man who sells you your newspaper in the morning, or the woman you pass in the park when you're walking your dog. To see the point of this stage, we need to examine our emotional life a little further. Although we may not like to think so, in the usual run of things, our experience of what we imagine to be positive emotion is likely to be sketchy and intermittent. Whether or not we're aware of it, this is partly because we tend to limit our affection to those we deem deserving of it, usually those who are likely to return the favour. But the chief characteristic of metta is that it is entirely without self-interest. It is not possessive or selfish and has nothing to do with appetite. This is why friendliness, although it may seem insipid, translate metta more accurately than love. Being applied only to other sentient beings and having an inherently outgoing quality, friendliness is more likely to be relatively free of self-interest. I say relatively because a great deal of what we think of as friendliness and even friendship involves a need for something in return. When we give affection, we want something back. And when a little intensity develops in our friendships, we can end up with a dependency that has something of the nature of an unspoken contract. The Pali term for this mixture of honest affection and an expectation of some return is pima. The Sanskrit is prima. It is usually translated as affection in the limited sense of an ordinary human fellowship, and it is contrasted with metta, which is the corresponding, more spiritual emotion. Pema is often understood to be the natural affection and goodwill that arises within the family group, and it is undoubtedly a positive emotion. Indeed, it is the cement that holds social life together. Expressing warmth and affection to your family members and close friends is a very good thing. Through your affection for them, you learn to set aside your own narrow self-interest and get a sense of yourself as being involved with other people in a very real and tangible sense. But your family, your circle of friends, the supporters of your football team, the members of your ethnic or cultural group, are only a tiny fraction of the universe of living beings. What might it be like to feel the same warmth towards everyone you meet, whether known to you or not? This may seem like a naive dream, a well-meaning fantasy that could never be realized. But before we give up the whole idea, we could consider the implications of one of the essential tenets of Buddhism: that in reality there is no separate self, and that we are related, directly or indirectly, to everyone else. If we reflect on this, we will come to see that unlimited friendliness is not a dream at all. It is we who are in a dream when we imagine that only our close ties with friends and family are important, while relationships between other families and other groups are of little or no consequence. When we look at things in this way, we have to admit that our relationships contain more than a little self-interest. Indeed, the very warmth of our relationships with family members and close friends can be what makes the rest of the world seem cold, unfriendly, and uninteresting. Through our relationships, we are seeking security. We want things to stay the same. We want the relationships we build to provide a refuge against the difficulties and uncertainties of life, thus guaranteeing the stability and security of our own small, inward-looking world. We need those people, those relationships, if we are not to feel terribly alone and vulnerable. We are, in other words, desperately attached to them. An attachment that is entirely bound up with Pema. Pema is essentially a social emotion conserved with... Pema is essentially a social emotion concerned with preserving the human group rather than with transcending boundaries and reaching out to all life however it manifests. If Pema is love or friendliness that can express attachment, Metta is love or friendliness that is not self-referential at all. Both are positive in their own way, but Metta is positive in the spiritual sense, whereas Pema is a more worldly emotion. Pema is love and affection for others in the ordinary human way, ranging from erotic desire to a simple warm fellow feeling, a sense of human solidarity with others. Pema provides a useful contrast with Metta, as the two words are close enough in meaning to be confused with each other, so that Pema or Pema is sometimes identified as the near enemy of Metta. Metta is much more than the warmth of good fellowship or a gregarious feeling of togetherness. Unlike Pema, Metta includes no attachment, no self-interest, no need even to be near its object, much less possess it. Metta is not necessarily a reciprocal emotion. As already mentioned, you can cultivate metta or friendliness towards someone without that person knowing about it. Indeed, without your having any connection with them at all. You can even express your metta in practical ways, by putting in a good word for someone, say, or helping them financially, without there being any personal contact between you. Ordinarily, we feel affection more or less exclusively. Indeed, the more intense the affection, the more exclusive it tends to be. When we use the word love to describe our strong feeling for someone, that someone in question is usually just that, someone, an individual. It is a strong partiality for that one person over and above everyone else. But when you feel metta, a strongly developed feeling of goodwill towards one person will tend to spread more and more widely. Being without self-interest, metta is impartial. Just as the sun is not selective in the giving of its light and warmth, when you feel metta, you don't choose its recipients or keep it for those you deem worthy of it. Metta is love that breaks out of the narrow confines of self-referential selectivity, love that does not have a preference, non-exclusive love. If we are going to use the word love at all, we could describe metta as disinterested love. It is, of course, interested in the sense of concerned. It is not uninterested, but it is disinterested in the sense that when you feel it, you have no thought of what you might get back in return. There are a number of English words that include a quality of disinterested love or appreciation in their meaning. Philosophy, for example, is the love of wisdom for its own sake, not for what is to be gained from it. Wisdom is essentially useless. Whatever practical purpose it might have is incidental to what it is really about, the direct realization of the truth of things. Similarly, metta is concerned with its object purely for the sake of that object in itself. There is in metta no desire to impress, or to ingratiate oneself, or to feather one's nest, or to gain favours. nor is there any expectation of emotional reciprocity. Being friendly or offering friendship to someone in the spirit of metta is something you do for their sake, not just for yours. Metta is not an erotic love, or parental love, or the love that seeks the admiration and esteem of a particular social group. It is a cherishing, protecting, maturing love which has the same kind of effect on the spiritual being of others as the light and heat of the sun have on their physical being. We really can learn to love in this way. This is the value and the challenge of the third stage of the Metta Bhavana. Doing the Metta Bhavana. Fourth stage, feeling metta for an enemy. In this stage of the practice, you try to make that person the object of your metta, not on account of anything they have done or not done, but simply because they are there. We have already seen that to practice the metta bhavana effectively, we need to learn to detach the emotion of which we have become aware from the person towards whom we are feeling it. Success in the meditation depends in a large measure on how pliant one's mind can be in this respect. You probably won't be able to do it straight away. It takes quite a lot of practice. The challenge is particularly great in the fourth stage of the meditation, when we try to maintain our feelings of loving kindness in the presence of someone who is perhaps intent on doing us harm. The method of the Metta Bhavana is systematically to coax the habitual reactive mind into the first glimmerings of positive emotion by concentrating one's thoughts and emotions on real individuals, with all their virtues and failings. However, sooner or later you will have to detach the emotion from these particular individuals. Metta is essentially objectless, and in the course of the practice it should come to depend less and less on the nature of the object and more on itself. This is what it means to say that metta is ultimately impersonal. It is no less an emotion, but it is less dependent on particular persons. You feel the same metta, the same emotional response, towards the so-called enemy as towards the so-called friend. This does not mean eradicating the particularity of our emotions. Metta expresses itself in different ways according to the differing nature and differing degrees of intimacy of our different relationships. What metta does is to infuse our positivity with the heightened energy that previously arose when we felt anger or hatred towards an enemy. The Metta Bhavana is fundamentally a practice of transformation, not annihilation. The aim is not so much to obliterate our negative emotions as to redirect them. There is energy in anger, and if we are to attain the ultimate good, nirvana, all our energies, all our emotions, positive and not so positive, have to be released in the direction of that goal. Rather than suppress negative emotions when we can and allow them to run riot when we can't, the aim is to transform the energy in them and integrate it into the existing stream of our positive emotion, thereby making that positive stream of emotion stronger. Here again, there is an important role for reflection. As Santideva advises us in the Bodhicharya Vatara, or Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, reminding us of the central Buddhist insight of conditionality, he points out that people who do us harm do so on the basis of conditioning factors over which they have no control. A person does not get angry at will, having decided, I shall get angry. Anger and hatred arise owing to factors outside our conscious control. and the anger with which we respond to anger is also irrational. There is no justification for anger and no point to it. Anger and hatred are states of suffering that can only lead to further distress. So there is nothing to be gained from perpetuating them. Shantideva goes on to encourage us to reflect on the painful consequences of our anger or hatred, and to inform our emotional life with the only rational conclusion to draw from these reflections, that unhelpful emotions should be abandoned for more positive ones. This is the only effective way to help beings, including ourselves. Such reflections may help a little, but our emotions are rarely susceptible to reason alone. It is relatively easy to acknowledge that we feel ill will, and certainly easy to talk about turning it into love. But it is not at all easy, actually, to bring about the transformation. If the kind of reasoning that Shantideva proposes is to be successful, we need to ensure that all our emotions are lined up behind our spiritual aspirations. If they aren't, anger and hatred, for example, will make their presence felt in a way that obstructs those aspirations, in the guise of righteous indignation, for example. We may then find that we simply cannot get started on feeling metta for our enemy. It is an unfortunate fact that our emotional life very often tends to lag some way behind our intellectual development. We can analyse our situation indefinitely, but without a fair degree of self-knowledge, our feelings will tend to remain tied to their old familiar objects in an ever-recurring cycle of craving and dissatisfaction. Directed thinking is important, indeed essential, but we also need to find a way of working directly on and with our emotions. Our task is to unlock the energy uselessly tied up in harmful feelings and channel it into positive and productive mental states. If the object of your attention brings up intensely negative feelings, it can be difficult to get any grip on metta at all. Positive emotion no longer seems even a remote possibility. Just for that moment, you seem to have forgotten what metta might even feel like. If you are beset by strong feelings of resentment, anger, jealousy or craving, you may feel that they are just too much for you to handle at present. If you have presented your emotional positivity with too great a challenge, it may be best to withdraw temporarily and retrace your steps, dwelling for a while longer on someone towards whom your feelings are more straightforwardly positive, before returning to this most difficult but vital stage. We need to be able somehow to grapple with the very idea we have of this person as an enemy. We have probably designated them as such because they have upset us in some way, and now we are maintaining this fixed view of them by dwelling on the injury they have done us. The solution is simple. Concentrate on their more attractive qualities. In order to draw your attention away from someone's irritating habit of always arriving late, for example, you can direct it towards some mitigating factor you have overlooked. They may be turning up late because they are devoted to looking after their young family, for example. You focus on their positive human qualities, or at least the problems which they face. At the very least, you can reflect that they are not always performing injurious actions, or perhaps not towards everybody. In this way, you can learn to paddle against the stream of your ill will. You can even begin to like your enemy just a little. But while such a shift in your feelings is a very positive development, it should not be taken for the arising of metta itself. Liking someone is not the same as feeling metta for them. Our usual attitude towards someone perceived to have harmed us, which is what an enemy is by definition, is to feel hatred towards them. But in this stage of the practice, you try to make that person the object of your metta, not on account of anything they have done or not done, but simply because they are there. Irrespective of whoever is around, or whether there is anyone around at all, you are aiming to be entirely equanimous in your attitude of loving kindness. You are not so much feeling love for your enemy as simply being undisturbed in your attitude of metta towards all beings by the thought of someone who has done you an injury. Although metta is in a sense the rational response to reality, in the end it is produced without cause or justification. When we practice the metta bhavana, our feelings of goodwill towards beings do not arise on account of anything those beings may have said or done. We simply wish them well. If it were otherwise, metta would be no more than a psychological thing, coming and going in dependence on whom we bring to mind at any one time. As a spiritual quality, metta is not bound by any kind of stipulation or qualification or condition. It is not meted out according to whether beings deserve it or not. According to Buddhism, there is no entity corresponding to an unchanging self underlying all what we do and say and experience. If there were, then one might approach the fourth stage of the metta bhavana with the thought that underneath all the bad that one can see in someone, there is something good that is still lovable. To view a person as essentially good, despite their unskillful actions, suggests there is an underlying person there to begin with. Buddhism, on the other hand, sees a person not as an entity that can become sullied by unskillfulness and then cleansed of impurities, but as the sum total, and nothing more than the sum total, of their actions, bodily, verbal, and mental. If we are trying to direct loving kindness towards somebody of whose actions we do not approve, what is it, then, towards which we are really directing our attention? As far as Buddhism is concerned, a person is not any kind of fixed identity. There is no underlying self that is somehow capable of performing actions while remaining essentially unchanged. Those actions are precisely what that human being ultimately is. Hence, it is self-contradictory to speak, for example, of hating a person's actions, but not the actual person, because the person includes the action that you have just said you condemn. The villain of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, Angelo, who asks with rhetorical sarcasm, "Condemn the fault and not the actor of it," is quite right. It can't be done. In this penultimate stage of the metta bhavana, you deliberately call to mind someone who has hurt you, not in order to change your opinion of them, but to test and strengthen your attitude of metta. If your metta is genuine, it will not be disturbed by your thinking of a so-called enemy. Taking in their bad qualities with their good qualities, you direct metta to the person as a whole, good and bad. This is very much the sense in which we speak of the limitless compassion of the Buddhas towards living beings. A Buddha's compassion, which is the response of metta to suffering, does not emerge in the form of isolated acts of loving kindness that you somehow earn by your devotion or some other deserving action. A Buddha has the same attitude of metta towards beings, whatever they do or don't do, because that metta is beyond time and space. It exists both before and after those beings committed any action or exhibited any quality, skillful or unskillful. This is not to say that Buddhas condone unskillfulness, only that their metta is unaffected by it, and they do not threaten to withdraw their limitless care and concern. Indeed, as it is limitless, you will not get more of it by behaving better. A Buddha's metta is rather like that of a loyal friend whose attitude does not change even though you have done nothing to upset them. You may apologize to your friend and beg forgiveness, but they will continue to feel, and perhaps say, that there is nothing to forgive. The metta of the Buddhas is unwavering. They are entirely compassionate before, during, and after whatever might have taken place. For this reason, we need never approach them with the slightest fear or apprehension. To sit in judgment forms no part of a Buddha's business. Nor, therefore, is there any need for us to ask for their forgiveness or mercy. Buddhas do not, after all, administer the law of karma. Conditionality will go on operating, come what may, and nobody, not even a Buddha, can save us from experiencing the consequences of our foolish actions. The unconditional love of a Buddha takes place on a plane altogether beyond such concepts as enemy or person, in the way these terms are generally understood. You can love someone unconditionally, as a Buddha does, only insofar as you believe unconditionally that they can change, however apparently hopeless the state they are in. This means being unconditionally willing to help them evolve, irrespective of the point at which they have now arrived. If they have abused you, you fully take in what they have done and still you wish them well. Truly loving someone does not mean seeing them as perfect or their moral weaknesses as unimportant. Quite the opposite. The more you care about someone, the more you are concerned for their spiritual welfare. With the warm and unflinching gaze of metta, you see them as they are, warts and all.